Welcome to the Great Security Debate. This show has experts taking sides to help broaden understanding of a topic. Therefore, it's safe to say that the views expressed are not necessarily those of the people we work with or for. Heck, they may not even represent our own views, as we take a position for the sake of the debate. Our website is greatsecuritydebate.net, and you can contact us via email at feedback@greatsecuritydebate.net or on Twitter @securitydebate. Now, let's join the debate already in progress.
Have you guys seen the movie The Dissident?
I've not.
No.
You guys might have heard the story on the news, but not understood the background of Jamal Khashoggi when the Saudis killed him in Turkey.
Yeah.
And they definitely killed him. There's no question. I mean, they've full out admitted to it.
Well, it's been admitted to, right?
Yeah. But do you know the background of Bezos owning the Washington Post, who Khashoggi worked for, and how they were having guava in the desert, that huge conference that was supposed to be the billionaires from around the world coming to invest money, and Bezos backed out? Do you know one of the reasons why?
No,
but we're about to find out.
The Saudi kingdom had invested in Pegasus through the Israelis, and with Khashoggi, they were able to verify, like, yes, his phone, but the way they got to Khashoggi was a dissident that was living in Montreal that had communicated with him. So they knew that he was also the person that funded the bees, and the bees were the ones trying to elevate the social media because basically the Saudis had hired a team just like Russia had, so that Vision 2030 and all these other things would always rise to the top of the cream, and nobody else, if you had anything against the government, would never get up there. So what these guys did was get SIM cards for everyone. Well, and here's where it comes back around. At the end of the day, literally, MBI had sent, or MBS, Mohammed bin, and I'm going to mess up the last name, had sent a message to Bezos, because they would communicate regularly through WhatsApp, that had something embedded into it, so he got into his phone. He had the amount of data that the government here in North America was able to prove traveled back to Saudi Arabia from that phone, on everything in his personal life, you name it, anything he was able to get into was incredible. And when you look at the timing of when it was leaked that Bezos had an affair and everything else, all that information was basically stolen from him. And the last part of that entire movie, The Dissident, was all about literally the Pegasus system and the ability to basically break into phones, and how they could use that then to not just, because everyone always says, well, what information are you actually storing on your phone that you could pull? But they were able to get into email and everything else. And so they had an unbelievable amount of information, right? Especially coming from somebody at the very, very top. And I was thinking about that. I was like, we've always said we didn't necessarily worry about cell phone so much, right? That it wasn't necessary. I don't say worry about it, but when you look at like the compute engines, the servers, et cetera, but from a cell phone standpoint, watching that movie, and when you say like the government people they had in there talking said, you know, typically we worried about Russia, Korea, China, and Iran. He goes, we never really considered Saudi Arabia. He goes, but then when we began to put together that the amount of information collecting that they were doing and the control that they had just on what's allowed to be fed within their own country, because Twitter blew up over there because people wanted to be able to use it, but nothing else they had allowed them to have that type of freedom of speech. And then that collectively started to be shrunk down on what they could actually view in their country. The ability for them to buy a system to then go out and hack phones, so that anybody that was part of, whether it's somebody that left Saudi Arabia, anybody that's part of the family. That same time period that that happened to Bezos was the same time period that there was over 30 family members from the royal crown all arrested and rounded up for, I think it was considered corruption and other charges. And that all that information was being gathered through the cell phone connections. It just made me, that was one movie about just one aspect of the murder of somebody. Right. And then it made me think they can't be the only country that's ever paid X amount of money for the Pegasus system.
Well, and if you, I mean, you take that back to some of what we were talking on the last podcast, that becomes really interesting because we watch all these companies that make the change. We're doing it for a good reason, right? It's a new feature. We're connecting everybody. It's going to be the greatest thing. But at the end of the day, what are they doing? They're creating that pile of data. And, you know, Dan, I think you tagged us on a link recently on data lakes.
Right.
And that becomes interesting. And if you look at the cell phone, you know, that this is why I applaud Apple and what they're doing in locking down the cell phone, because that is the gateway to so much of what we do. Is if you look at the majority, you know, outside of security, people that are very active on social media, which I guess is technically what we're doing here. But that's the phone is the entryway into your digital persona online. For the corporate, it's your gateway into email, into file sharing, all of that. So with Apple putting such a focus on locking it down, it's definitely a positive for the industry. Because I remember going back a couple of years ago, and see, I'll be the first one to pull it back into automotive. But we were having a conversation about the connected vehicle. And the connected vehicle, it was, I forget who it was that was mentioning it, but they were talking about, and this was from one of the OEMs, that no matter what controls they put into the car, the weakest link was always that phone. That was a piece of technology that they could not control, but had to control for, that it could come into, connect into the car and had to plug into all these different systems. You know, it's, you know, the craziness of creating all of those air gaps and controls, much like what we saw in what was it, airplanes, right? And what was able to be, you could go from an infotainment system to all of a sudden get to the controls of the plane. And it's the phone is at the center of so much of that. I mean, in that case, I guess in the airplane, you know, change out the phone and it becomes the entertainment screen that you're playing with. But it's that UI interactivity with the human that ends up being the focal point and connectivity into everything else. I feel like I kind of rambled there, but
no, I thought you pulled it back in, especially on the automotive side, going to the vehicle. That was one of the big conversation points, was you have this ability now for infotainment in the back of the vehicle for all the children, for everything else, right? And how do they use that? Well, if we could connect in, if I could just have my Netflix account, then they can watch whatever they want. I don't have to carry around this lug of DVDs. But if I could do it from my phone and just connect my phone up so that they have this to listen to, or I connect out, there's so many different examples of that in the thought process 5 years ago. And then when you see it on the airplane, and I shouldn't even say 5 years ago. I mean, this is going back almost 10 years ago on the infotainment systems. I think there's a lot of interesting conversation around that, especially like you said, the amount of data, you know, tracking from a cell phone, then you look at from a vehicle, the amount of data you could pull. And then you look at the same company we were just talking about, Amazon, that happened to Bezos from his phone standpoint. And now they're working on connecting to create the city sidewalk or the everything connected.
Which is a PSA for people. This goes live this week, June 6th, I believe. So if you don't want to opt your Echo or other Amazon-based spy products that you've installed in your house, there are processes to opt out of it from, but you have to do it from each device, and each device type is different. I'll include links in the show notes.
There was another thing in the news. I don't, did you guys catch SolarWinds is back in the news?
No, do tell.
So SolarWinds has a private equity firm that kind of sits above them that's been pumping in money. There was a lawsuit that was filed against SolarWinds, and it just jumped over, and they're now targeting the private equity firm to say that they did not put a focus on security.
Interesting.
That ultimately led. And that, yeah, that becomes very, very interesting. And you think about it, I think we could each tell stories of private equity firms we know that were purely focused on maximizing profits at any cost, or you get the alternative, saddle a company with debt, spin them out, or crush them, and then you're out from under it. But this could be a huge, huge precedent. And you know, the reason I was kind of thinking about that, the legal, because there was another one that Dan, you published, you kind of picked up on what happened with the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act.
Yeah.
That is, there's a lot going on in the legal realm right now as it pertains to security.
Yeah, there is. And, you know, the idea that this, I think it's actually heading in a really good place. You know, we've talked for a long time about the fact that information security has become part of business. And why has it done so? Because there's been teeth, because there's been public relations, because there's been customer blowback when, you know, when things happen either to the company or to the people or to the data that's held within the company. And it's those sticks. I don't think yet that security, you know, there's carrot and stick models to getting people and companies to comply or to do good things around security. I think we're still in the stick model. We're still in the place where it's the penalties that put the fear in it rather than doing it either for growing business or for because it's the right thing to do by default. And of course, there are exceptions. But the, you know, the issues here with the computer, and I'm going to mess up the, because there's the US version and the UK version. The UK version is the Computer Misuse Act. The US version is the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. The US computer, by the way, the UK CMA is being reopened as well. It was written in 1990. Totally not fit for purpose today. That one has some slightly different issues in that it puts actual security researchers, so people, information security professionals at risk of violating the law by doing their jobs. So it's totally not written right for the modern day. They've agreed, the Home Secretary there has agreed and announced that they're going to reopen it and fix it. The in the US though, there's, you know, the Computer Fraud and Misuse Act is, or sorry, Computer Fraud and Abuse Act is equally as old. It is equally as ill-prepared. And this particular piece came out that the Supreme Court ruled that the act of breaking in is illegal, but there is not necessarily, the act does not cover the use of the data of the ill-gotten gains from that particular attack. And it was a really interesting eye-opening moment as to, okay, fine, the act of breaking in. Now put this into 1988 Matthew Broderick War Games. I broke in, I got data. The breaking in was the illegal part, but the data itself has, you know, there's no penalty for it. This is a big problem now in today, because it's the data that's the problem. It's the data that's being used and held against people. And so I think this, you know, this drives some further change. It's going to be have an interesting ripple impact into companies as to how they deal with this and how it affects boardrooms. But juxtapose that against SolarWinds. And the fact that there is the fact that there is now board accountability in a way that had previously not been quite so clear. You know, and it's not just it's not criminal, because what do we fear more than criminal? We fear massive lawsuits. So you know, this is a really interesting turn of events, and I think that boards are going to become even more aware of this. I think, you know, the parent and holding companies, investment companies, PE firms are going to become even more cognizant of the fact that they have to be, you can't just be gutting, because you're still responsible for the overall security of the product and of the customer base. It's a really interesting turn of events. I'm very interested to see how this plays out in boardrooms in this next round of quarterly meetings across companies.
Yeah, I was reading the article in regards to the officer, because he was originally charged, I think it was like 18 months in prison. And then he filed again. Well, he went back to fight it, and it kept going through the court system and until it got to the Supreme Court and they made their ruling there. And not to go backwards to SolarWinds, but with the business the way the software companies, and there's more than just SolarWinds that are set up in this light, where they have some type of software that they sell that maybe is proprietary and has their namesake on it, but then they also resell other people's tools. And I think that's one of the things that is being looked at, because you had a certain setup of tools that you were able to sell, but you decided not to use those tools. Why would that be? If you think these are the best tools in the market and you're selling them to hundreds of thousands of customers, why did you not look internally? But I'll stand a little bit mute on that, just because I feel like
that brings up an interesting thought though. Now, are you negligent if you buy a product? Security is great at buying, or security teams are great at buying technology and then putting them on the shelf or not using them. Now, does the mere fact of owning it mean that you, and not using it, mean you had the opportunity to do so and now you're negligent?
Well, now it gets into all your legalese, right? If you think about all the contracts that we've written, it was all commercially reasonable efforts to protect the data, or tying it back to gross negligence. Well, I begin to wonder, to your point, can you now start tying that back? Sure, you made the effort. You bought the tool, you spent the money, but you never actually implemented it. You never built any processes around it. Is that gross negligence?
I also need to stand a little bit mute on this too, but I definitely know that there are several companies out there that, from a cyber insurance standpoint, needed to get an EDR in place. So they purchased it and only deployed like five, right? Over the span of several months.
This is the problem. This is the problem we've had for the longest time in security, and it's checkbox security, right? The controls framework says I shall have this, check the box. That's not security. Compliance is a baseline. Now, there's a lot of good frameworks out there that help you create a solid baseline, but I know we've had this discussion around the culture of the company. And are we just good enough, or do you need more flair to your outfit, right? Are you doing the bare minimum? It becomes so, the legal side of all of this becomes so interesting. And it was yesterday. I was talking about this and kind of, are you familiar with the concept of the law of the horse?
I'm not.
So I forget the background. I believe it was a professor out of Harvard, in terms of, it was kind of, it came around in the concept of cybersecurity and creating laws around it. And the idea was that the law of horse, and I apologize if I completely butcher this, but the concept of law of horse, that you need to make legislation broad enough that it can cover not only a horse and carriage, but you could extend it to cars much more. And that's what you get into cybersecurity. You get a legal system that traditionally has not understood the legalese around the high tech of what we do. So then you end up creating legislation that is very broad, and you get all of these different applications of it. Well, conversely, if you were to go the other way of that and say, all right, well, legislation should be really honed in and really detailed, by the time it gets signed into place, it's outdated. We've already moved past that. So it's so interesting kind of watching as that shifts. And I'm really interested to see if the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, if that gets rewritten, if it all of a sudden they replace it with something else. I'll say it. I think in our field, there needs to be some more regulation put around it. That, if we look back, you had Sarbanes-Oxley that came on the heels of Enron because they were cooking the books, they were hiding things. I begin to wonder if we see that same type of progression with cybersecurity. Now, granted, when you're cooking the books, I think if you look at generally accepted accounting principles, they are fairly rigid. Right? There's not a lot of wiggle room. This is how you're accounting for money. This is how you're doing things. With cybersecurity, it's a little bit nuanced. To use Dan's favorite, it depends.
Nearly enough lately.
Yeah, that's true. I think we've said it more now on your behalf, but we do credit you every time we say it. So
I think also because recently it hasn't depended as much.
It's been a lot more concrete. Absolutely.
Right. But I think it becomes really interesting. And I think we do need some additional legislation. And I mean, my understanding, I think on the privacy side, there's some stuff moving through the federal system that would take the place of all the states creating their own.
There are. The question is whether they have a meaningful chance of actually making it making it through the making it through the system. But the privacy ones have momentum at the moment. I think a lot of legislators think we've got breach notifications sorted, so we're good to go. I don't think that that's necessarily the case, but you will also see breach provisions showing up in these, in the various privacy laws that are out there. And there are increasing numbers of state-based privacy laws that are aggressively making their way through the various state houses.
One thing I think is kind of pertinent right now too is with any type of an executive order that comes out, with any type of news such as a hack like the Colonial Pipeline, when an industry starts to hear that there could be rules put in place or there could be more oversight put in place, they start to look at, and this is, I work for a vendor, they start to look at the green, right? That now there's a place for money to be made. So now you get more lobbyists in there saying, well, these are the things that you should absolutely demand that people are using or the rules that should be followed. And I don't know, and I think you guys would agree, things change so quickly in cybersecurity and the way we're using technology that even if you went back to read, because the law of the horse, what cyber law might teach, and it starts out with 2 years ago in a conference, 2 years ago, and even from 2 years ago to where we're at today and the way the tools are used or the way the threat actors are coming at you or the way ransomware suddenly just saw this giant increase or suddenly work from home because of a pandemic that nobody saw coming, you know, let's say mid 2019. And it changed the way people were using technology. It changed the way you use firewalls and everything else. I just think there's going to be a lot of people pushing a narrative into Washington and a lot of people in Washington that probably don't have the background or the understanding of all the different tools that are actually used and really what threat actors are doing, and people stand to benefit and make a lot of money.
Yeah. And I want to just a quick point on the piece you mentioned, that's actually written by Lawrence Lessig, who is one of the, I will never be able to account for all of the things he's done, but he's a, you know, phenomenal professor, phenomenal speaker, but also an expert on things like the law of security, law of privacy, information and information flow. And he's also the creator of Creative Commons. So, you know, these are, you know, that alternative to the standard copyright system that has become quite, you know, well entrenched in the world. So, you know, it's interesting to read his perspective on this, the law of the horse, what cyber law might teach. I've linked it in the show notes. Please go take a look. It was written in 1998. But I think the things in here are, remain interestingly relevant.
So Brian, I'm going to take the opposite of that, though, because I think as technologists, it's the concept of if your favorite tool is a hammer, everything looks like a nail, right? And that's what we do as technologists, that we want to meet with the evolving technology. Technology is evolving at a breakneck pace. I think we can all agree on that. Right. But I think as we look at security and we boil it down to the back to the fundamentals, that as we get into least access, kind of mantra, get into vulnerability management, asset management, software management, those core tenets fundamentally haven't changed. Now we've got tooling and better ideas of ways to do them, but those core components are there. And I think if legislation starts to hone in on you have to be this tall to ride, these are the elements you want to have to put in there. Now there's got to be something around the definition on what that actually looks like. Otherwise you're just going to get that checkbox. Well, my asset management, I got a spreadsheet that has everything in there. Sure. That matches the words that are in there, but that's not the intent. Right. So it's going to be interesting. I don't see it coming anytime soon, just because of all of the nuances that would have to be worked out. But I really think that we got to continually focus on the fundamentals. And it's the same thing that, you know, you look at, you do work for a technology company, that you guys are an amazing company, but if you put an amazing technology on a crumbling foundation, you just create a ton of extra noise and chaos that you can't manage, right? You still have to have that good foundation.
Yeah. And Dan, you said it too. I saw one of your posts recently about the Colonial hack and coming back to a password and said, as many fuzzy, bright blinking button tools that you could have bought, at the end of the day, it comes back to some of the simplest things, which could be training. I mean, I don't want to get too deep here, but this goes back to like when there was a war on drugs or the idea of safe sex and how you talked about that in schools, right? You could buy a million different tools to properly, I don't want to get down that rabbit hole, but the point is education was really, really important, right? And how you address that at home and at the school, right? So while I do definitely agree with you, Eric, I think you guys have a great community here in Detroit, okay? And the people that understand not only the fundamentals, but are also talking about them like we try to do here on the show, or the Cloud Security Alliance and those groups. But when you look at the number of businesses in the state of Michigan, many, many of them depend on somebody else to explain to them what they need. And the person usually explaining that to them is somebody trying to sell them many tools.
Yep. Oh, absolutely.
Very true.
What do I not know, and what do I need to buy to begin to know it? And I'll sell you a great car that way. So just to turn this around, Eric, you made the mention about industries that are that don't have regulation, or that, and as soon as many industries don't have regulation around many things, including information security. And as the specter of regulation starts to rear its head, or you start to hear the noise in the distance, it's often a driver for those in that particular industry to go, no, we got it. We'll sort it out. Don't regulate us. But this week, we saw two different interesting commentaries coming out of Washington. And this is not political, this is just factual. President Biden issued two things. One, an executive order on cybersecurity. And I only use the word cybersecurity because that was what it was titled. I still am not a fan of the title of that particular phrase. I'm going to go, that's the hill I'm going to die on. And two, there was I can't remember if it was a speech or if it was some kind of admonition around the need for baseline security in pipelines, because these are, privately run industries. They hold something that's part of critical infrastructure. They clearly have not been doing what it takes uniformly across the board to be able to protect their things. So we're seeing messaging coming out of Washington on that. Similarly, on the compliance side, there was a similar kind of admonition around from President Biden around the need for increased compliance to root out corruption. So these, and I live now more in both of these worlds of compliance and security and privacy. So these kind of edicts are coming out of Washington, and that's great. There's visibility, but do they help the cause? Do they actually push forward the cause of maturing information security, or is it met with a collective eye roll?
It depends. Yes. Boom. So does it help the maturity? I don't want to say it definitively helps the maturity, but I think if you create baseline creep to the, if we were to say to move left down the spectrum is to get more immature, right down the spectrum is towards maturity, right? If you continue to creep the baseline up, I guess technically speaking, you're upping the maturity. You're kind of upping the, it's almost, this gets political, but I hate to say minimum wage, but it's similar to that, right? You keep raising the bar a little bit higher.
Right.
You're always going to have your companies that are going to meet right at that bar. There's no way around it. And
well, you're going to have the person who only puts 20 pieces of flair because that's all that's required.
Right.
I will link to the movie in the show notes for those of you who have not seen Office Space. And if so, you got to see it.
And the verticals on which that'll apply is so interesting as well, because I think you have verticals that don't have the capability to self-police because the ramifications, if they don't meet their own objectives, are not harmful enough for them to care, right? So when dealing with PII, we've seen that you'll see customer attrition for a while, but then they come back. Look at Target, right? I've seen some good cases on that where their stock dropped and they came back and they're doing a great job now. As an organization, I guess tangentially, we'd say they're doing an amazing job right now. Anybody that's actually used their pickup service, they're killing it.
So and it means kudos, I don't have to go Target. In. It's wonderful.
but I think that goes to show there were very little ramifications on that. Now you take it to the manufacturing industry, your ramifications of self-policing are huge because I have a down line that now hurts. That is the bottom line. So now I am a proponent in, or not a proponent, but I would be a candidate within manufacturing that manufacturing itself could self-police because of the ramifications to the bottom line of what that does to revenue, right? There's direct impact.
There's enough stick to make me want to do it myself rather than have somebody else have to tell me.
You don't need to find me as the government because I already know that if one of our manufacturing lines goes down, we're in deep trouble. Right.
Because you could look at the Suez Canal, the deep freeze, and how people compare that to security, et cetera. The difference there is that a manufacturing company that's affected by that would just claim force majeure. It's the last thing that your customer wants to hear, the large OEs of the world. But when it comes to cyber, if you get hit with ransom and you're shut down, you can't claim force majeure, right? Like,
what is force majeure, Brian?
So things that are outside of your control that could shut down, force you to shut down production, i.e. a fire that occurs, right? Or when I say a fire, that let's say a forest
natural
fire that
shut wild down fire, X,
Y, or Z.
Right. Yeah,
Acts of God
is typically how. Yeah.
I was trying to like look it up real quick, like to get the actual definition there. But so when you look at the deep freeze, I mean, yes, that's uncontrollable weather shut down all the petrochemicals. Now you saw that seating just to get foam up and going was shut down. I still can't get white ceiling paint, right? They told me it would be a month. It's going even longer now. So for those flat colors at Sherwin-Williams. So to Eric's point, there are certain verticals that could do a very good job of self-policing themselves. And then there's others that there's no impact from the self-policing big enough to want them to do it in such a way that they're following, like you said, the right controls or putting the right products in place. One thing I wanted to toss out there, because Dan, you wrote about it this week as well, but security debt. And as these new requirements end up being put in place or additional oversight, now you look at companies that had invested in certain products that maybe don't meet the right controls, or they had never considered those levels, and they're in verticals that now they have to go look at that, and they have built up now what you would call there's technology debt and security debt, paying for things that they're not actually using or that aren't actually doing the job they intended them to do now, because the environments have changed. But I think that's another aspect of some of the stuff that you're seeing coming. And then the business has to look at that and say, really, how much money are we spending on our security tools to meet whatever criteria that we've set, and what are these new criteria that we have to meet? And if it's in manufacturing and there are controls put in place because your customers demand them, how are we meeting those and still meeting the demands of our business?
Right. And what's your process to reevaluate those criteria on an ongoing basis to make sure they're still applicable? That's I was playing with a diagram recently, and I'm sure you guys are familiar with the CI/CD pipeline.
Yeah.
Continual integration, continual
deployment.
Deployment. Yeah. So it's kind of that infinity eight. And I was thinking about that. That should be applied to security as well, right? That as soon as something goes into production, we're circling right back to reevaluate it and make sure it's the right move. I want to jump back real quick to something you said, Dan, because you were talking about the government and President Biden trying to curb corruption. Did you guys catch what's going on with the Mexican government and privacy and collecting fingerprints and retina scans?
No, I don't think I have.
Yeah. So for some reason, I don't think this is making mass media, but the government has come out there and now said that if you're getting a cell phone, that you have to give up your fingerprint and retina scan. That they are creating a central database. So back to this idea of what are we collecting, creating that data lake. They are creating a central repository for all of that.
Does that mean if I'm in Mexico using my cell phone?
No. You have to buy, it's when you buy the cell phone within Mexico.
Well, it's a more advanced, and invasive approach. I mean, even in the US, you can't register a cell phone. There was a time, you know, back in the good old days of burners, you know, true burners, you could buy a phone, grab it off, start using it. Nobody knew who was using it. Now there is almost a KYC in banking. There's know your customer, where you have rules about identifying the person who is, who's opening an account as an attempt to quash money laundering. Even in the US, that same rule exists today in cell phones. There has to be a registered owner for it. Somebody's name has to be on it. Now, the controls aren't nearly as rigorous in terms of vetting an ID, taking a scan of your passport or your driving license in order to get it, but it is definitely there. So this is just, this is, you know, granted, a much bigger leap forward. Although on some quick searches, it looks like about a month ago, a judge granted definitive suspension of that data, of that registry in Mexico.
Oh, did they?
If this is an old, this is new to me just in the search. It looks like it may have been suspended. I don't know if it's back since then, but that was something I just found.
Okay.
So it's an interesting, really interesting topic. So now it's the balance of knowledge and security versus privacy. Five other episodes we've done on this topic.
And if you look at it, it's another one of those things that I think was put into play, or they were talking about it with a good intent. The idea was it's exactly what you're saying on the burner phones in dealing with the drug cartels. But what are the long-term ramifications that now I have just created a honeypot? Oh, that is going to be great. If I can break into the trove of data that's in there.
And even if let's take out the internal misuse use case. Let's put that off to the side. Now it's in a government agency. Others could use it. How is it being used? Is it being, I'll port this into the US by immigration, by law enforcement. Blah, blah, blah. Let's take that off to the side. Right. You've created this massive, gorgeous, big thing with a Target logo on it. With a Target on it that is saying, please come attack me.
And I think there's something else to that too, because I'm reading it and on the 27th of April, it was actually the Mexico Data Protection Body that started to challenge that. But what other country do you think was supporting them to say, do you think you could get this done? Do you think you could start collecting this information?
I'm sure it was the US.
I mean, I'm just throwing it out there because
is that a factor? I mean, you see that's in what you're reading or you're, oh,
it's not, surmising. It's not, okay. This is just simple throwing it out, throwing it against the wall, see if it sticks. And the reason I say that is you look at how some of the data the U.S. government was able to collect by just clipping into lines that popped up overseas. And because it wasn't being done here, it was being done over there, but you were seeing the communications from all the people that lived here in America. You're like, yeah, but at the time, England had some really loose laws around that. And you were able just to go ahead and clip in on the lines coming up and you're sifting through some of the information. If you have a country that legally is allowed to gather that and you have an investigation and you're working with them in their country, such as maybe a organization such as the CIA would be doing, or even the DEA would be doing, that information becomes extremely valuable. And I'm just saying, completely speculative.
We've now entered tinfoil hat time. I think what it does is it highlights the complexity of national or local laws in a connected world that is globally connected. And of course the Star Trek fan in me and the idealist says, let's get one set of universal set of laws for the world, and we operate in a single manner, but probably not in my lifetime.
I found that really interesting though, that share. So
yeah, I put Eric, it in the notes.
Yeah, thank you for throwing that out there, because I think I had never even heard about that or read about that, so it definitely kind of scooted the news agencies, or at least the social media here in the US.
Well, which would you rather have collecting the biometric information, the Mexican government or the government or TikTok? Because it looks like TikTok yesterday announced some new some new updates to their terms and conditions in which it allowed them, where permissible by law, because there are U.S. states that are absolutely not, it's not permitted to do so, to collect biometric information from the videos that people post, facial maps, et cetera. And I'm currently waiting on my $350 check back from Facebook for doing this in Illinois, where it is absolutely against the law. To make some of these moves is pretty interesting. The world of facial recognition is not going away. So is this a place where we need national legislation as well? Or legislation of any kind? I think there's only 5 states that have anything on the books on this.
A move of any kind is probably better at this point. It's the terms and conditions. I know I've said this before. It's outrageous what can go into some of those things. I almost think that if you want to put it into a law, I think terms and conditions should go by the way of Twitter. You have a character count. Here's how many characters you can build your terms and conditions. That's all you get, and make it human readable.
and mean something.
Yeah. And for people that have never read a terms and conditions before, go in and just pull up Facebook's terms and conditions, right? And take a look at how big or how long they are. I don't know anyone personally that has ever read all the way through them, unless they were in law and they still never read all the way through. They read certain sections. Never mind.
As Dan's raising his hand.
I'm going to take a moment of being a proud father. So my son is in a public school district, and I come across in this year with the move to significant technology. You know, I'm a pretty loud critic that K-12s don't take privacy and don't take security into what their purchasing decisions are. This third-party risk management concept it just falls flat. It's buy the tech and do it. So I'm pretty critical. And if anyone's in a K-12, I would love to help you, as would many of us in the industry. Please reach out. That said, I come across my son in a Zoom breakout room earlier in this school year, and they're looking at a new piece of technology that was deployed, and he had the terms and conditions and the privacy policy open with his classmates, and they were reviewing it and talking about how this data was shared with third parties and therefore they refused to use it. I was a very proud father, and then I waited the phone call that would inevitably come, but it didn't. So, but no, I mean, terms and conditions are a horrible thing. They're written for the law. They are written not to be read or understood by, they aren't specifically geared to be understood by mere mortals. And therefore, you can't make a meaningful decision as a user about what it is whether or not you want to use the service or not. You have to depend upon others reading it and crying foul and being outraged before you realize that, you know, what it is that using the service does. And then they just click boom, 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 boom. I'm playing around with, you know, we always talk about Wyzer and their security awareness. There's an interesting video in one of theirs about don't just open up the app and click okay. Just making that message for people to understand what they're getting into when they're launching a new application, either for their own personal or within an enterprise. But yeah, thus ends my diatribe on terms and conditions.
But I will say though, and I think you kind of hit it on the head when you said that, I mean, where applicable law prevails, or, you know, with those, right. I think those are in most terms and conditions. And I think that's why we need to push for a privacy law. Terms and conditions are made to protect the company. We need something to protect the consumer,
right,
that overrides those.
Yeah. And in those cases, so in the it was interesting. There was a good discussion going about this, about TikTok's changes yesterday, that in the states where there are rules against this, a user will be specifically asked if they're okay with it. But in the states where it's not required, it just happens and you don't even know it. And I don't think that's okay.
Can I ask the two of you guys a question outside of the terms and conditions, not to change gears?
No, you can't ask it.
This goes back to the pipeline.
I need to write the new terms and conditions to allow you to ask the question. Hold on. All right.
And then it needs to be ratified at a council.
Yeah, exactly.
Once a month meeting. And
accept this, and then you can ask your question.
Accepted. I didn't even read it.
I'll look for my $1,000 payment in just a moment.
This is like the voice recording. It's like the automated message. Just so you know, this call may be recorded for training purposes.
Yeah.
Please acknowledge.
Exactly.
So Brian, so you all heard it here. Brian has officially accepted the new terms and conditions. All right.
But doesn't know what they are. Go ahead.
To be used in any which way Dan seeks fit. Colonial Pipeline hack, immediate response within a month from the U.S. government stating, you know, the administration really trying to take a harder stance. Was it the Colonial Pipeline and the fact that gas prices went up, or was that more of like kind of the straw that broke the camel's back with AON and some of the other big names out there, that when that happened and they saw the total effect, that maybe you could look at that as critical infrastructure and what's the impact on the rest of our critical infrastructure? But the last time I checked, gas pipelines weren't part of critical infrastructure.
I think that the impact, the potential impact of the pipeline shutting down, and I think also combined, now this is just my own assertion, I have no inside knowledge or about this, but the, you know, the idea that the pipeline was shut down, and from what we understand, the pipeline was shut down not because the pipeline itself was compromised, but because the billing system wasn't able to bill people, that led to increased prices and outages and shortages of gas, made it clear that that you have to have some controls in place and you have to report the breaches. The fact that the reporting of the breaches was part of the verbiage in this makes me wonder if there's a little more beneath the surface. I don't know, but it certainly sets my mind wondering that there's, you know, either time to announce or there wasn't necessarily completeness. I know some of this was investigated through other means and not necessarily disclosed by the private company. I mean, these are private companies doing this work that are still accountable to shareholders for right or wrong, and not necessarily the public, not necessarily the customers.
Because I was looking at it, I've had this conversation for the last 3 weeks, that this is just a beautiful example of what could be looked at as supply chain. And the fact that all the different vehicles that get filled with that fluid, right? That fluid shut down, you couldn't get it in there. But most people don't realize that if you were able to shut down like a single source bolt supplier that supplied bolts for, let's say, 6 of the 10 largest OEMs in the world, you would shut down production of many companies, right? And many vehicles overnight. And I looked at it as a similar example of, when you shut down that spigot, the ramifications in different types of manufacturing verticals is magnificently high in terms of the cost, right? And the impact. This was, in my opinion, an example where an entire community, entire nation could see it on a map, drawn out all the little branches. But if you wanted to look at the supply chain, just saying, and I'm going to do it in automotive, and look at the impact that one supplier can have should they get breached. And that's what some of these threat actors have figured out, that, you know, rather than target the biggest company on the block who might actually have a good security posture, we can target somebody within their supply chain to shut them down, whether it's manufacturing and now, for instance, a gas pipeline. And I'm not saying they didn't have a good security posture, right? And I shouldn't have hinted towards that, but you could shut down what could be looked at as supply chain, but mm-hmm. the supply chain of a fuel or the supply chain of this material. And it's the same thing that just happened with the beef outfit out of Australia. That impact of shutting down every single one of their processing plants, they haven't talked about it, but now look at the backstream of that and the number of animals that were probably set up for slaughter, right? Or in the process of being slaughtered, that all of that will get scrapped, right? And then you begin the process over again. It's the same thing with the pipeline, or I shouldn't use the word pipeline, the automotive getting everything ramped back up again, just to get steel turned on.
Well, it's a pipeline, but not an oil pipeline. It's a pipeline of supply. It's a supply chain pipeline.
Yep.
Yeah. And I think back, you know, you look at both of those and there's in cases where there is worker pay for no work, meaning you can't run a line, or there's spoiled product like meats or animals that won't be able to be you know, won't be able to be processed. Now you have a backlog. You have Bodie McBoatface in the middle of the Suez Canal. And that caused amazing backlogs. These are the kind of things that make it, that make companies understand the impacts that companies and the public understand the impacts that these kind of interruptions have. And I think they're incentivized. Companies are incentivized because they lose money. They lose tons of money to a flawed product. And if cybersecurity, if security, if ransomware, if any of these things are factors that can cause that, they're going to take those pieces of sand out of the oyster wherever they possibly can. So they're incentivized.
I'm going to build on the supply chain and tie it back to ransomware. And one of the things that I've been mulling over my head, and Martin Bally posted a good article, and I think we may have covered it in one of our podcasts, that there's been a ransomware attack that was three-pronged now. That was, we encrypted your data, pay us to unencrypt it. We exfiltrated your data, pay us to not release it. But then they also went out to the consumers. And in this case, it was healthcare information, and said, consumer, you pay us, or we're releasing that data. As that pertains to supply chain, and this is where I think there's going to be a lot of open mouth, insert foot with companies that are coming out now. Everybody's jumping on the bandwagon as it pertains to paying ransomware or paying for it. And everybody's coming out, oh, we'll never pay. Is that totally true? What happens in the supply chain is one of your little critical companies gets locked up, and then they come to you and say, hey, you want that company to be released? You're going to pay us, or we're going to bleed your supply chain on raw materials that you need into your plant, which causes domino effect up the chain. Put in that position, I have no controls to leverage my backups. I don't have any controls to get us back in line, because it's an environment completely out of my control, whereby paying may be actual. I feel like I'm putting an idea out there that we'll now see play out, but I could see in those instances that you're paying to get your supply chain back online. I don't think we're too far off from seeing that into some of our manufacturing environments.
Well, the Colonial Pipeline, the CEO came out and basically said it was cheaper to pay than not to pay. There's a whole host of ethical questions around that. There's soon, I think, to be a whole host of legal questions. If you start to,
there already are.
Well, they're vague and hand wavy at the moment. I think they're going to become more formalized.
Who was it? I forget which agency came out, and I thought this was last year, and said, depending on who you're paying, that may be an organization that is already on a watch list, and now you are funding. Oh, yeah. It could be terrorism. It could be those things, and now you've directly funded that.
Yeah, I mean, there's OFAC. OFAC is part of that. Yes, both from a bribery perspective, from a fueling terrorism perspective, and from a foreign nation's embargo perspective. You know, all of those have the potential to play in, but the enforcement of it has not been clear. It's been, we really, in a similar way that that law enforcement will say, we strongly recommend you don't pay the ransom. They will you also need to do what it takes to get your business back up. And we're not going to arrest you for having paid a ransom, but at the same time, we really, really, really recommend that you don't do anything to continue to propagate this.
But the thing is that in Eric, I think what you were referencing is if it's somebody that's sanctioned, right? Whether it's a government or a person that's been sanctioned, it's actually a federal crime to pay that person or do business. And that's what you're doing. But I'm going to throw out a big example to Eric, because I think this pertains. And I think at the end of the day, an OE, whether it would be, you know, you just throw out a name, you know, Volkswagen, Ford, Toyota. Let's say that you were the supplier of occupant detection systems for airbag release. So this isn't just chip shortages and we'll build vehicles that don't have, you know, X number of chips in them. No, for the occupant detection sensors, let's say you control over 50% of the entire business, similar to how a certain airbag company controlled over 50% of all the airbags in the world. You get hit and you only have two manufacturing plants globally, and both of those plants are shut down. and they know like what you supply, and they just come back to you and say, hey, we know that this goes into every vehicle by these three automakers and 50% of the vehicles in these two automakers. We want $50 million, right? And you're like, sure. I don't have that. You turn back and it's already day one. So all those OEs know that you've already been shut down because they've known within 4 hours. And you explain to them that this is what's being asked for. I mean, they're quickly going to do the math and say yes or no on the pay, or how long are we going to be down, right? It's really, from a business side, like that's how their business would look at it. And from an ethical standpoint, Dan, I get it. But it's like you said, Eric, this could be by vertical self-policing, right? Because those are the conversations that are being had now. This isn't just a matter in certain verticals about, you know, quality shutdowns or production control shutdowns. It's cybersecurity shutdowns. And now you're looking at from the P2 side, from healthcare and banking, right? And how do we protect those verticals? And now you're seeing it in such things as, if you want to call it critical infrastructure or something that we depend on very heavily, which is oil or gas, or take it be water. Not that somebody can shut down water, but imagine if somebody targeted companies that supply bottled water. There are enough areas in North America right now that depend on bottled water as their source of drinking water that they would be heavily affected. And those right. people don't have the money.
Or if you're able to manipulate controls in some said state, much like it might have been Florida, and put chemicals into water, might have happened.
That's all just made up, though. Certainly didn't happen in Florida.
That was back to passwords, though.
It does, and it does. And I want to. Unfortunately, we're at the top of the hour, so I'm going to wrap this up with just the idea that taking. Allowing yourself to leave ransoms in the equation as a default position. Now, as a fallback, as a failsafe, as a we've tried everything and we can't go back to it. Maybe there's some merit, but the idea that ransoms are an alternative to good security, because in many of the cases we've seen recently, it's been poor fundamental security, not lack of whiz bang technology that that detected it. There's basic things, open VPNs, unpatched VPNs, compromised passwords, and people allowing and granting that information. And then falling back on, we'll just pay the ransom, or even worse, our insurance company will pay the ransom, leaves a default position of I don't have to care. Now, couple that with some of the lawsuits that are starting to show up that we talked about earlier with SolarWinds and others that start to make people care. And we're going to come to a reckoning between these two sides, these two different philosophies in the CIO's office and in the boardrooms. And I'm really interested to see where that goes and how that plays out. And when we do, we'll bring it into a future episode of the Great Security Debate. With that, we've reached the end of our hour. Brian, Eric, thank you again for yet another really great discussion around information security, privacy, and all things that depend. We will be back with the next episode in 2 weeks, and we look forward to seeing you there. In the meantime, we love your feedback. We thrive on your feedback. So please give us your feedback. You can email us feedback@greatsecuritydebate.net. Visit our website, www.greatsecuritydebate.net, or our Twitter @securitydebate. If you have a podcast app, if you listen to us through a podcast app, please subscribe, leave some feedback, leave a rating. It helps make this a lot more visible. And tell your friends. They can subscribe, Great Security Debate, www.greatsecuritydebate.net/subscribe, or it's available in all of the major podcast search engines. Until then, we'll see you on the next Great Security Debate.